This is Amy Poehler. My new movie, Disney and Pixar's Inside Out 2, is coming to theaters June 14th, and it's making me feel joy and sadness and anger, definitely some disgust,
Rose,
and I think a little fear.
Really?
But I'm also feeling these new emotions like anxiety, embarrassment, envy, and ennui.
It's what you call the boredom.
Okay, that one was weird. It's going to be the feel-everything movie of the summer. Disney and Pixar's Inside Out 2, only in theaters June 14th. Get tickets now.
You are listening to Comes a Time with Oteil Burbridge and Mike Fenoya. If you're digging the podcast, do these guys a favor and review and subscribe. It means a lot. Be sure to follow the pod on social media, YouTube, and if you're joining for bonus episodes and exclusive content, go to patreon.com/comesatimepod and get on the bus. And now, here's Mike and Oteil.
Welcome back to Comes a Time, y'all. Oteil here. Man, today's podcast. I am so excited I was able to get this guy on. His name is Jeffrey Kripal. All my favorite things come together in this. Music, UFOs, theology, paranormal experiences, the whole nine. Jeffrey J. Kripal holds the Newton Razor Chair in Philosophy and Religious Thought at Rice University, where he chaired the Department of Religion for 8 years and helped create the GEM, GEM program, a doctoral concentration in the study of Gnosticism, esotericism, and mysticism, that is the largest program of its kind in the world. He's presently serving as the Associate Dean of the Faculty and Graduate Studies in the School of Humanities. He's also the Associate Director and Center for Theory and Research at the Esalen Institute in Big Sur, California. He has written a bunch of books. The one we're going to be kind of talking about is this one, The Flip: Epiphanies of Mind and the Future of Knowledge. A lot of what this book is concerned with is scientists who were formerly not believers in anything metaphysical whatsoever that had a crazy experience that flipped them. We hear of this in religions, like they say, oh, he had a road to Damascus experience like Paul had, or it would be called a religious experience. But these aren't like in the context of any religion, especially since most of these scientists were atheists, you know. But there are people that didn't really believe that had something just undeniable and life-changing and happened to them that changed their minds. I found him from like UFO podcasts, but being a theology nut, the scientists that are starting to step out of the shadows that study this stuff from a technical standpoint, you know, a lot of them are military or in three-letter agencies or whatever, but they are now coming to people in the humanities. And actually since the 70s, they've been going to psychics like the remote viewing program out of Stanford Research Institute. We talk about Ingo Swann, who was maybe the best remote viewer out of all of them, and I think helped create the program, the structure of the program. And so it's not totally new, but now there a lot of them are coming out like they have to be written about under pseudonyms, people like Professor Gary Nolan out of Stanford, you know, Hal Puthoff is now out and doing YouTubes and, you know, it's, they're coming to people in the humanities and in, parapsychology or religion departments to get, their take on this, like, because some of these things, like Jacques Vallée, says, you know, what would have been called angels before, maybe fairies in another time and another place, look very much the same as aliens now in a technological era. You know, beings that come from out of a shaft of light. And, you know, so that's, you could see that in myths and fairy tales and Bibles all over the world, right? So he's like, maybe we're just getting hung up on semantics here. Maybe this is all kind of the same thing. So Jeffrey Kripal, man, this guy is one of my favorites. And I'm really grateful to you, Mr. Kripal, for giving me your time. And he's already said he would come back and do some more because we couldn't possibly fit it all in into just an hour. And he's got, well, 2-year-old grandchild, so he had to go. And my kids are getting out of school, so I gotta go. But enjoy this one. It's a really good one, and there will be more to come. Peace. First of all, thank you so much for giving me any of your time.
It's an honor, Oteil. You don't have to do that. I appreciate it. And I do this all. I describe myself as intellectually promiscuous. I just say yes to everything. And it's a mistake, by the way, because I'm always on some podcast. I'm like, yeah, they don't want to hear that. I've said that story so many times. I'm just like, oh my gosh.
No, I want to hear it all because I was so grateful to find people like you. I've been searching, thankfully, the internet. Like, I'm like, it's not just me. I'm not crazy. Because, you know, it's actually just you,
Oteil. You're it's you.
Well, it's a lot to ask, you know, like theology, UFOs, you know, music, art, geopolitics, clandestine, you know, conspiracy, not theory, conspiracy history, I like to say, you know. So it's a lot to ask for me, and I lose people all the time. I'm sure, you know, you're around more people like that than I am. So.
Yeah. Yeah. My experience, I've said this a lot, but when I talk about my ideas in the abstract, people look at me like I have three heads or something. I'm just like, what? That is the dumbest thing anybody's ever said. But then when I embed the idea in a life story of my own, they're like, oh, that actually makes a lot of sense. And so I've learned to tell stories, and I've learned to like talk a lot about my life because not because I'm a narcissist, I hope not, but because it actually makes sense. It makes sense to people when they hear those stories. So.
Context is everything, right?
Yeah, it matters a lot. It illuminates stuff in a way that I think is really helpful.
So for fans that don't know, just I want to start here with the flip.
Okay.
Can you give them just like a short, you know, flip for dummies, cliff notes, like what is a flip?
Yeah, no, I can do that.
I know it's not, you know, it's a lot, but
the flip is a phrase. I'm sure I borrowed it or stole it from someone, but it refers to this idea of, particularly with professional scientists and engineers and medical people, they're trained to think of the world in objective ways, that the material world is what exists. And the subjective world is hallucination, is not really real. And the flip is when these very people have some kind of life-changing experience and they realize that actually the reverse is true. The subjective world of mind and consciousness is primary, and the world of matter and objective reality is secondary. It's not that it's not real. It's just that it's secondary. And what they realize also is that their science or their medicine or their engineering doesn't change a whit.
And yes,
it works as well in this new flipped worldview. And they realize that their earlier materialism was a kind of ideology or brainwashing that the culture had put on them, and that they didn't need it, and it's actually not true. But of course, we all think it's true because most of us haven't flipped, and usually this is something really dramatic. I'm not talking about just a change of mind. I'm talking about a near death experience, a psychedelic trip. A contact with a UFO or an entity of some kind. I mean, I'm talking about something really life altering that happens to these people, often completely unbidden. Oteel,
like they
don't ask for this.
Yes, it's proactive.
And it has its own, well, to speak philosophically, it has its own agency. It has its own intention and will, and it's not ours. It's not the human beings.
And thank God mine have been for my betterment, at least. And I think, mine's not seeking to do any harm, so I'm glad for that.
But I guess the thing to say is sometimes these flips, they're very difficult to deal with because they don't fit in to the religious worldviews or the cultural worldviews of the person in question.
Or the scientific worldviews.
Or frankly, the religious worldview. Sometimes they hit head on with religious training or with just family assumptions, whatever those family traditions are. And so I don't want to suggest these flips are always easy or even in, they're never innocent. They always come with a lot of implication, and they're often the most important thing that ever happened to this person. That's the other thing I'll say. We're not talking about something that happens to you drinking coffee in the morning, and we're talking about something that happens in a car accident
A lot of we're not talking about little synchronicities. We're talking about a phrase that keeps coming up, ontological shock. Yeah. So my main flip, I've had a bunch of them. I guess it's not really a flip because I grew up in such a already pre-flipped household. Maybe not my dad, but all the rest of us. And so when I had an extreme situation, that's when it happened. Mine was bidden. I did ask for it, but it came immediately. It was like, oh, what? But, I was desperate. So I just engaged with it and I didn't question it. And it did completely change my life. And all the people who were here when it happened can attest to that, But it was a shock. It was an ontological shock. So I think a lot of people... I wonder if there's some connection between that and this DMT being endogenous. So what I've heard, and I don't know if this is pop culture, but I've heard it said that DMT is released in some kind of extreme situation, like when you're dying or in war, something extreme where it gets released. And that's the strongest hallucinogen. So I had this theory that Colonel Bruce, one of my mentors, just had it, more of it running around in his body.
Yeah.
Because he could just see things other people, he could see a ghost behind you or something and no one else would see it. I don't know.
Yeah. No, I just tell you a quick story here. One of my colleagues is Whitley Strieber, who's the science fiction writer and also wrote Communion, which is not fiction, which is based on his own set of experiences. And Whitley is, he's like what you're describing. I mean, he's not a normal human being. He's, he's what I call a mutant. And he just sees things and things happen to him that don't happen to other people. And I've learned over the years that, some people are just different.
Yeah.
And they're... And I mean that in a, I mean that in an ontological way, and we should define that term. I mean, by ontological, we mean something dealing with reality. We mean metaphysical. We mean something that's really real. And the DMT thing, you know, the psychedelic or psychoactive molecule, you know, there was a research group in England, and they called me, or they emailed me. They must have emailed me. And they wanted me to come over to England to talk to them about DMT. But what they really wanted me to do is bring Whitley Strieber. And I said, well, Whitley doesn't do psychedelics. Why are you interested in Whitley? Come on. And they're like, oh, well, we think it's endogenous DMT release. We think the visitor or the alien abduction experience is endogenous DMT being released into the system. And I, oh, that's like really interesting. That's an interesting idea, actually.
Yeah. Which doesn't mean it's not real.
No, but what, and there are different ways to read that. So they were reading it as DMT is not causing the experience. It's allowing it. It's essentially a catalyst that lets the entities in, as it were, or it's what's released when you're dying so that your soul can leave the body and access the other world. But you can also read it reductively and say, oh, well, this is a hallucination that's caused by psychedelic compound, you know? So it's sort of that ambiguity or that paradox that they were really sitting on. And I actually really was fascinating. And by the way, I did bring Whitley and we did go to England and we talked to them for 3 or 4 days. And that was really fascinating, actually.
It's funny
imagine,
when you
could imagine.
Yeah. I love it.
Whitley's response was funny. Whitley's response is, Jeff, there is no way I'm doing DMT. My life is weird enough.
It's weird.
I do not need a psychoactive molecule. I'm like, we get it. That's fine.
That was Colonel Bruce. He never did drugs.
Yeah.
People are like, and when you say DMT as a catalyst to allow something to happen, that's like the describing Colonel Bruce.
Yeah.
Like if you're with Colonel Bruce, you would see it. He would be like, look over there. And I'd be like, how did I miss that? Like, if you weren't here, I would have totally missed that 100 times.
Yeah.
But somehow he was a catalyst, and I could, like, so I never did any hallucinogens when I was with Bruce.
Yeah.
I was like, oh my God, no. But being with him was a trip. It was a trip, you know?
Well, there was something going on in him that was different again. And I know exactly what you're talking about. I mean, that's how I feel around Whitley. One of my descriptions of him is he's a shaman in a culture without any shamanism.
That's Bruce.
And so it's like, we don't know how to understand you. You know what? We're just going to call you crazy because that's the only category we have. And I'm like, well, that doesn't work. That's a dumb way to handle it. But that's actually how a lot of people handle these things, is they just say, oh, he's crazy. Well, he's not.
But you know what? That kind of thing conversely could keep him alive. Yeah. Oh, he's crazy because, you know, what he could do could get you killed. Seriously, you don't want that kind of screen. He knew it. Oh, I'm just a fool. I'm crazy. I glue pipe cleaners to my face.
That's the mutant again, right? I mean, that's the whole mutant mythology. And
100%.
So that's why I use that word. I mean, it works. It just works.
And all my heroes are the mutant. Like one of my favorite people, the sax player named Wayne Shorter, there was an album that they had called Mr. Gone. And I found out decades and decades later that was named after him, that they used to call him Mr. Gone. And then I finally got to meet him and he was very childlike. And it's a beautiful documentary that came on him. And very late in life, he just started collecting fairies. Like, I have wrestling figures. They were all over the place, just fairies everywhere. And I was like, yes, because, you know, I'm team Harry Potter, Lord of the Rings, the elves. When we recorded in Iceland at some point later in this podcast, you got to remind me to tell you the experience that we had with the elves that lasted a week.
Like, it was tons of witnesses. Tons. It was crazy, you know. But they, all my heroes have this kind of, like, I see it as a thread as when I go back and look at all of them in time, like, you know. So did you ever have a flip experience?
Yeah, people always ask me that.
If you don't want to talk about it, it's totally fine.
No, I've written about it. So it's not, it's not a secret. I always just kind of pause here because it's, I'm not a specifically gifted individual, O'Teal, in that I haven't had a lot of these experiences, but I definitely had one in, it was actually Calcutta in 1989, and it was an out-of-body experience. It was what most people would call sleep paralysis or a Kundalini awakening, but it was pretty major. And it wasn't the full-blown abduction or Kundalini awakening that people talk about, but it was enough to make me extremely sympathetic when I heard these stories. You know,
so can I ask you one question real quick? You seem to equate the two, like they're parallel, abduction and Kundalini awakening.
I think they're very much related. You know, if you listen to people who have had abduction experiences or contact experiences, they'll often talk about an energy that starts out in the bottom of the spine. And that's just classic. That's classic Kundalini. And, you know, the Kundalini experience, that's a South Asian Hindu or Buddhist way of talking about a phenomenology that I suspect is universal. And so I don't want to privilege the Hindu or Buddhist framing of it, but the truth is they've done more than anyone to sort of theorize this, so why not? Let's use it. I mean, if it's sophisticated, it's sophisticated. So I do think these altered states of energy and mind are present in both of them, and I think the modern abduction experience is a kind of science fiction framing of an experience that's very ancient and very, very old and very, very human.
And technological speak.
It's sci-fi. Sci-fi is what it is. And but in a really, I mean, because sci-fi gives us a way of talking about this.
I mean,
so why that's what our culture gives us, and so that's what people have, and that's what they see and they experience. And you know, people will often say to me, well, it's just sci-fi. And I'm like, well, no, because a lot of the sci-fi was inspired by these same states. So there's like this, there's another flip there,
and a lot of that sci-fi came true, like Arthur C. Clarke.
But there's also some of the greatest sci-fi authors and artists had paranormal experiences that they then turned into science fiction. So there's this flip that's going on. It's like there's a paranormal background to the science fiction, which then informs other people's paranormal experiences. So there's a kind of loop going on here that I think is really useful and really powerful. But that's in the South Asian case, they're not going to use that language. They're going to talk about Kundalini and the subtle body and the chakras and all kinds of stuff. And that's another cultural framing of it, I think.
Yeah. I was having this thought connected to that I've been saying there is no science without magic, because that which is doing the measuring can't be measured. And I had this thought about language, like when you I'm not sure if it's Diana Walsh Pasilka in your book, one of you was talking about the certain scientists getting their ideas from this other realm.
That's Diana, by the way.
And I thought, well, isn't all of it from the other realm, like right down to language? Like all of it is art or representation in some way. So, and I don't know the answer to this question, but it seems to me logical that all of it is coming from the other side. You know, like they do work together. It's not
I'm not a scientist, O'Teal, and so
me neither.
I don't I don't speak for the sciences and I don't try to represent them. But what I have argued for decades now is that major ideas come from altered states. People don't think their way to major ideas. That's just nutty. I know that's what we're supposed to believe, but it's just not true. People get downloads and they get inspirations from places they're not aware of. And in the sciences, sometimes what happens is the scientists will get hunches or intuitions, but then they'll turn those into experiments and they'll do the math. And they'll turn out that the math is right or that the experiment works. But sometimes, of course, it doesn't. And so I think, yes, some science is certainly all comes from altered states. But of course, most science doesn't. It comes from hard-nosed math and experimental replication, essentially. And so I want to, I want to acknowledge that the sciences are different. On the other hand, I've never met a scientist who's not a human being.
That's what I'm saying. Like, it's still someone's consciousness doing it.
Something's doing the science, right?
Exactly. And what encourages me is when some of the scientists, like, I don't know the guy's name, but I think he won a Nobel Prize from the polio vaccine. But someone said they got it in a dream. Or the Indian mathematician who's everybody acknowledges.
Yeah.
Can you say his name for the people?
Ramanujan is his name. Ramanujan. I mean, that's a good case where he argued that a goddess wrote these equations on his tongue, actually. And I'm sure she did. But it turns out that the equations are correct. And he didn't have the proof of them. He knew the result. He didn't have the steps to the equation. So he was, he was clearly a genius. And he was receiving these mathematical equations or proofs in a way that his culture allowed and encouraged.
Yes.
And I think, I did actually study math a lot, but in many, many moons ago in high school. And what I remember, though, about the math was math is really weird. And the reason it's weird is we're just making this shit up. I mean, we're just like making it up out of the blue, and it turns out it works.
But this is what I'm getting to. Science, ultimately, it was, and I think still is, if some will admit it, a creative process. Just like art. There's an art to science.
Yeah.
I'm curious about music. You know what I mean? And I try things out. But then I also hear some things, and I try to match that with what I'm hearing. I don't know where that comes from, what I'm hearing.
Well, music is math too, right? I mean,
exactly.
Right. I mean, come on. I mean, that's what... Yeah, I am a musicological idiot, Oteil. If there were two classes I almost flunked in the seminary. One was Christian ethics. I understand that. The second was musicology. I could not hear what these other guys were hearing. I was just like, I don't know. I don't know. So I'm a musical idiot, but I know enough about music to know that it's math. It's math put to music, as it were. So, I mean, you have an intuitive sense of that.
Well, and that's what I was like, I've argued with musicians about this that don't believe in anything mystical. I'm like, but you're a millionaire because of it. We're not up here doing math.
Right.
Why does it make someone feel something? Why, if we play something, someone cries? Now it heals some part. And they just, there was a hurt there from a religious upbringing that was very hurtful. And I totally understand that because my dad was the same way. But I'm always like, we're not up here doing math, man. We're doing magic.
Yeah.
We're giving meaning. We're using math and vibration as a vehicle.
Oteil, so my job is to understand religion. That's what I do for a living. And by religion, I don't mean the stuff that abused, our parents or us, and all the bad feelings we have about. But the truth is that really what communicated religious traditions for millennia is two things. One is music, right?
Yeah.
The other is art, by the way.
Poetry, yeah.
Yeah. Well, art as in architecture or the visual arts, you know? And because most people in human history have not been able to read.
Yeah.
And I don't say that as a snob or an elitist. That's it's just true. It's just true. So how do you communicate a tradition that to a people that can't read? Well, you do it through art and music and rituals.
Songs,
And that's how most of these things have been carried for thousands and thousands of years.
And people don't realize like that that's still happening here in the United States. Even you don't have to go to some far off tribe. I was living in Birmingham, Alabama for 20 years, and I started riding motorcycles again in my 40s. I get way out in the country. I remember eating at this breakfast place. This guy came in, he was white, younger, clearly like a farmer, and we're both ordering, and I realized that he couldn't read the menu. And the lady said, "Can you point to the picture?" Because they had pictures of each breakfast, and he pointed to that one. And I was just like, you know, not being judgmental, I was just like, the first time I was like, yeah, that still happens right here around you and your big city, like everywhere out in rural America might have some of that still, you know.
And it's not just reading. I mean, the other thing that shocks me still, but is also true is, you know, I think most of us live in a universe in which the Earth is just orbiting a star and there are billions of stars out there and the whole thing's expanding. But there are a number of us still living in a medieval cosmos in which the Earth is at the center of the universe and everything's orbiting us. And I realized this many decades ago now. I was at a weenie roast with my family. And
great place to realize.
Well, that's what we're doing. You know, we were actually at a pond at a sand pit, actually, is what it was. And one of my uncles, we were just looking up at the stars, and he said something. And I was like, I was thinking to myself, oh my God, he thinks they're a few miles up there. You know? And I realized, oh, he's living in this sort of, you know, pre-Copernican universe. And it really stunned me because, okay, not everybody's living in this modern cosmological, you know, expanding Big Bang universe.
Or I would even say supposedly modern, because we're just like him to someone else, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and if you talk to cosmologists, you talk to quantum physicists. I mean, I know a lot of quantum physicists. I mean, they have the craziest ideas about things. I mean, just like
crazier than Jonah and the whale, right?
Yeah, I don't mean they're crazy. I mean, they know from their science that the reality is not what people think it is, and so they're willing to just speculate about things that I think are just wild to ordinary people, you know.
Thank God. I'm glad they're so inquisitive still. All right. I want to talk a little bit about Ingo Swann.
Okay.
Because all these things kind of go together. Actually, one thing I want to backtrack. You said that you did not do good in Christian ethics. Do you remember any books by Henley Barnett?
No.
In Christian ethics? Okay.
I don't. Sorry. I'm sorry.
No.
I was joking about Christian. I feel like I'm a very ethical person. You know,
wasn't saying you weren't.
For some reason, there were just two classes that I really struggled with. One was Christian ethics and one was musicology. That was the joke.
All right. Okay. Ingo Swann. When I read his book, Penetration, it was kind of pivotal because, you know, I had all these different streams of thought going, my own precog dreams, my mom's psychic stuff, Colonel Bruce's psychic stuff, lifelong interest in sci-fi, right? And all that kind of stuff that happens. And then I get to, and then this theological stuff after my flip. Then I get to Ingo and I see it all kind of like coming together. I found him through the remote viewing thing, and I've mentioned his name to Comes a Time viewers a number of times, as begging him, please go read the book, you know. Did you ever get to meet him?
No, but I know people who knew Ingo. And yeah. You know, we have something at Rice University called Archives of the Impossible, which are physical archives. And we have a lot of the Stargate project archives in our archives. And, you know, I've written about Ingo. I wrote about Ingo in Mutants and Mystics, this book on art. And
I got to get that book.
Yeah, you got to get it. What's wrong with you?
I'm working on you got a stack going over here already.
There's actually a whole section on Ingo in that book, including on penetration, by the way. And I've talked to people who knew him well and who were trained by him, by the way. He's a revered figure in remote viewing. He himself was an artist.
Oh, I love his artwork.
Yeah,
oh.
From he lived in Greenwich Village or somewhere in New York City on the Bowery. And he kind of came to the remote viewing, not by accident, but it wasn't his first calling for sure. And he was probably one of the most, he helped create the remote viewing protocol that was used at SRI or the original place in Palo Alto that trained these remote viewers. He's legendary. Penetration is his book about, of course, his experience meeting, having UFO experiences and meeting extraterrestrials, as it were. And he also, you know, he was a queer man, to use the modern language. And he writes a lot about sexuality and the interface between sexuality and paranormal experiences in a book called Psychic Sexuality that I also read and enjoyed very much. All of my early work, O'Teal, was about male sexual orientation and mystical experience. So I was really interested in what Ingo had to say about sexual desire, sexual experience, and paranormal events. And I was very intrigued by that book in particular.
Well, I've always thought it's a very heightened trance state. Obviously, tantric sex is used as a vehicle to get to these other states of mind or whatever, dimensions. I remember Ingo's comment about, he goes, well, everybody's psychic. And they were like, well, how do you mean? He goes, well, you know, what about sex vibes? You know, when someone turns you on and when they're turned on by you. And I was like, wow, there is just like a basic psychic, you know, thing that we all have.
Yeah, I think we vastly underestimate the sexual dimensions of these experiences. I'll give you a good example. You know, a lot of contact experiences and abduction experiences are highly sexual.
Yes, I've noticed that.
Sometimes we'll talk about that or we'll read about it, but then we'll just let it drop as if it's somehow unrelated. I suspect it's very much related. Mm. And I don't claim to know how, but this takes us back to the Kundalini stuff. You know, Kundalini yoga was very much connected to these tantric traditions, and they were very firmly embedded in this notion that the energies start out in the lower regions of the body, but then they rise up through the chakras into the head and beyond. And so there's definitely this connection between human sexuality and transcendent religious experience for those traditions as well. So I just think that this is really major, and we don't understand what's happening. And I think Ingo's work, to go back to Ingo for a minute, you know, a lot of my early work was basically arguing that what we then call gay people, gay men and lesbian women, but particularly gay men, because I studied male sexual orientation. There's something religious about it. There's something special about that particular sexual orientation, because it's not directed towards social ends. It's not directed towards procreation and the establishment of a family and a social life. It tends to get directed historically towards religious or spiritual ends. Not always, of course, but it has a strong tendency in that direction. And so a lot of my early work was basically arguing that these male homoerotic traditions are really the orthodox ones. They're what's dominant in the tradition, even though that's sublimated. You know, it's not direct, it's not genital, but it's still a man loving a male god at the end of the day. And so again, this is why Ingo's penetration and psychic sexuality were so interesting to me, because it was another example of this pattern I had seen in different religious traditions for a long time.
It's interesting, because I don't normally think of male sexual orientation connected with the religious experience.
I know
when you
don't.
Say those two together, but because Western religions have just, like, you know, it gets a bad rap. Judeo-Christian.
I know people don't normally make that connection, but it's obvious. It's obvious to me. It's obvious if you study religion comparatively and historically that they're definitely connected. How, again, I think is a mystery. We don't really know.
Can you give an example of, like, an obvious connection between male sexual orientation and the mystical experience?
Well, sure. So there are two major metaphors in comparative mystical literature for union with God. One is sexual orgasm, and the other is death.
So the French have it right.
yeah. So the little death is significant, but basically it's about absorption. It's about absorption into the other. It's about identity with the other. And so a same-sex desire also gets connected to celibacy. And when I was in a Catholic seminary, for example, Catholic men who chose a celibate lifestyle were inevitably suppressed gay men as well. And they were turning their sexuality in a way that was socially and religiously acceptable, and not just acceptable, it was admired. But they were doing that in a religious way, Oteil. And if you think about Catholic spirituality, it's all about loving this male deity, who in Catholicism is basically this naked man on a cross. And you're even eating his body and drinking his blood. You are consuming this guy. And so, I mean, I don't need to go further than that. But
it's like, how much further can you go?
Well, it's just staring us in the face, is what I'm trying to say. It's just so obvious. It's like, come on. I know people don't normally go there, and I know that will be offensive to some ears, but that was definitely my early work.
I mean, some truths are self-evident. This brings me to something I wanted to get into with you, which I thought would come much later, but I've often asked even rabbis about this, about Genesis 1:26, which says that where God says, we made Adam like us, male and female, we made him, not made them.
Right.
So
Adam was apparently a hermaphrodite before he got separated, which I think is really fascinating in this gender war era. That, like, it's right there on the first page. Can we talk about this? You know, so I think.
That's a very common ancient reading, Oteil, of the Adam and Eve story. That Adam was of both genders, like God, and then was split into male and female, or what becomes Adam and Eve later on. So that kind of queerness or non-binary nature of deity is really ancient and really, I don't want to say ordinary or orthodox, but that is a very common ancient reading. You are not alone seeing that.
I think it says as much about God as it does about Adam, because it's like, oh, we made him like us, male and female. So, you know, I pray to God, the mother and father, you know, then the Trinity makes sense. Father, mother, son or daughter, right? Father, mother, child. To me, that's holy. Me and Jess coming together to make Nigel is, if we keep it holy, you know,
I mean, to speak theologically for a minute, I'm pretty much of an idealist in the sense of I think we're all God. I think, you know, we're all particles or portions of God, which makes God very kinky. I mean, it basically—
Does it though?
What? Yeah, because he's having, or she or it or something, is
or
having
them.
Sex with itself over and over and over again in multiple forms. And— I'm fine with that, Oteil. I think
that's what we do.
No, of course, because we're.
I mean,
both,
me and Jess. Yeah. See, this brings up some other theology things that I wanted to get to with you, because you said at one point in the book that or one of your talks that religion has trouble with psychedelics because it's something about, I wrote it down, it's basically something to do with the separation between us and God, or God is separate from us.
Yeah.
And when I formed a theology of my own, because I wasn't raised religious, but just trying to understand this thing, it seems to me that in that particular story, when it says God breathed their breath into us to give us life, so that life in us is the breath of God. So we are not separate from God. Like Nigel, my son, is partially me. Like my DNA, half of it's me. So he is separate from me, but he's also clearly a part of me. And God, in creating everything, I'm like, can anything be separate from God? That's just my logical reading of it.
Yeah,
if you can use logic for that.
I mean, my comments on psychedelics, Oteil, had nothing to do with your theology. I mean,
I know, but
I mean,
I got you.
I'm talking about historical orthodox.
Their theology. Yeah.
Yes. Christian theology is that God exists outside the natural world and creates the natural world, for sure. God creates the natural world, but the natural world is not God.
I get that. It's a manifestation.
That's Orthodox Christianity, and that's what we call the ex nihilo kind of creation theology, that God created the world out of nothing, because the world is not God, okay?
And I get that.
What I was saying is, look, historically, monotheism, or the idea that God exists outside the world, has had a very violent past with psychoactive plants.
Yes, for sure.
And it has suppressed them, and it has literally killed populations that use them in religious ways, because you cannot have a religious experience because of a plant in a theistic or monotheistic world, because nothing in the natural world can take you out of the natural world. It can only take you in other parts of the natural world. So you can't experience God on a mushroom or on DMT if you hold this traditional theology. What I was saying in the interviews you probably watched was that I worry about the psychedelic renaissance, because I think its implicit theology is not that. I think
it's definitely is not.
I think it's more like what you're saying. And,
yeah.
And yeah. I'm just saying, look, there's a conflict there. There's a contradiction there. It's not that I am siding
with that theology.
Yeah. No,
yeah, I'm not saying that. I didn't think that, but I think you'll be encouraged to know that, you know, Paul Stamets is right.
Yeah.
He's I can't believe it. It's like a friend of mine now, but he has dealt with a lot of like evangelical Christian communities that are secretly taking mushrooms and having, I think maybe sometimes their first actual religious experiences. Yeah. I wasn't raised in a church. I had some experiences that I didn't consider religious, the dreaming into the future. But when I did my first LSD, I had full on, it altered my life, and now I play with the remaining members of the Grateful Dead. So it clearly took. But yeah.
No, I think that's true. I think psychedelics do give people access to the divine. I have no problem with that. All I'm saying is that is not traditional Orthodox
theology. To be sure. Yeah, and that's why I'm not in church now, because I consider myself, if I had to put a label on it, and I'll ask you about dual aspect monism, because maybe that's what I am, trying to figure out what I am. I just call myself, for lack of a better term, a heretic Christian.
Yeah, no, you're actually a mutant is what you are.
Now, but that's like what I'm more getting comfortable with now, because now I'm kind of getting more Jacques Vallée about it, like, we're killing each over other semantics, right? Okay, one locale in time, it's elves. Another one, it's angels. Another one, it's UFOs, aliens. Another one, it's, and I'm like, I don't care. Like, all I know is some people are more anomalous than others. I think we all have anomalous property, you know, we're all like X-Men in some way. Like, that's my thing, to find out what's my kid's right superpower and fan the flames on that, right? You know, like, so.
Right. I listen, I'm with you. I'm just my message is just, look, beware of these religions, because they're really nasty to some of this stuff historically. And to go to Jacques for a minute, I mean, you know, the UFO stuff, I mean, a lot of these communities see UFOs as demons, and
yeah,
it's not.
But you know, when they're abducting people and raping them, and
it's not an unreasonable conclusion.
Cattle mutilations don't look that fun for the cattle. I mean, I think it's a both and. Like, I think everything has polarity. So if there's good aliens, there have to be bad ones. It's like, that's why I can never be tribal.
Yeah,
because I can never trust a whole group as a group. There have to be bad and good of everything. So if there are aliens, there almost have to be bad and good. It's like people get bummed. Well, why would they crash? I'm like, if you're in the physical plane, there's entropy, like stuff fucks, you know, it goes bad. You know, I don't know. Like,
I don't. Yeah, I'm just saying. I'm just trying to be cautious with people about religious traditions. That's all.
No,
I'm not casting aspersions or making judgments about people's theologies or their religious experiences. I'm just saying, wow, historically it's been a horror show, by the way, historically.
Yes,
so let's acknowledge that, and let's not deny that, because we need to be really honest with each other now, and we need to be really, I think we need to just be honest with each other and tell each other what we're actually experiencing. And like the demon thing, let me just say something about that, Oteil, because I think this will throw that into question too. I personally am extremely suspicious of any demon talk.
Yeah.
And let's take the cattle mutilation thing, which, by the way, I think happens. I don't think we can explain it in the ways that it's explained away. But Oteil, We slaughter millions of cows every day.
Or just animal testing, just not even to eat them.
I mean,
just to test our makeup.
We are demons, clearly, yeah, to these cows. But to ourselves, are we demons? No, we think eating hamburgers and eating steak is a good thing. And I eat hamburgers and steak, by the way. I'm one of the demons to these creatures. So if a few hundred cattle are mutilated, okay, but is that really demonic when we're literally killing millions of these things every day?
I'm not saying that they're right, but I'm also not saying that we're not demonic, because we clearly are.
Well, I'm just saying, all I'm trying to push is that this interspecies relationship thing is really complicated.
Yes.
And species, first of all, they eat one another. Okay. You know, we do. It's not this pretty picture that people want to imagine. And So the language of demons to me is it really stops the conversation.
Yes.
About a lot of this thing, and it worries me.
Yeah.
A lot, actually.
Well, they're going to die soon.
Hopefully, all are. I mean, come on.
I mean, you know, that I just think that's kind of my way of making myself feel better, that a lot of people are hanging on to that old paradigm or have got one foot in the grave, and we can get on to the new things.
Yeah. Well, you know, the old saying, science advances one funeral at a time. I mean,
I said that when Avi Loeb came on the podcast. He goes, "Oh, well, I hope no one has to die." I was like, I was joking, but okay, never mind.
Well, the generations, sometimes it does take that, actually.
Yes, it absolutely does.
But sometimes, actually, future generations know less or do worse things than former. I mean, it's not automatic progress, unfortunately.
No, because that's how we have dark ages. I mean, we can't build a pyramid now. So, to me, technically, we're still in the dark ages because we don't know how they did it. Yeah. You know? So, but I hear you. It is it does stop the conversation, and it's probably one of the things that it's holding up disclosure. Although I don't need disclosure, for the fans that are not as deep in the UFO rabbit hole as we are, disclosure, as I understand it, you can correct me, Jeffrey, if I'm wrong, is for the government to come out and acknowledge this. That's right. I don't need the government. The government's been saying weed and mushrooms were worse than alcohol and tobacco for how many years, right? Like, the aliens or ETs or interdimensional beings or all the above or whatever they are disclosing themselves to people individually and have been for how long? Like, ever? Forever?
Yeah. No, I'm with you. I was on another podcast months ago, and the lead question was, what would religions do if there was full disclosure about aliens? I'm like, what are you talking about? There's been weird things coming from the sky and doing things to people for thousands of years. That is old news, you know?
Yeah.
That's what we call religion, by the way.
Exactly.
And, I'm not sure that went anywhere, but I think that argument is totally sound. But generally what people mean by disclosure is government. I'll tell you what does matter, Oteil, about the government coming clean on this is money.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I live and breathe in a university or an academic world, and I'll tell you that money is available to studying certain things, and it's not available to study other things. Yeah. And that then creates an order of knowledge that privileges some things and deprivileges other things. And so I think the flow of money is actually very significant, because it's also a flow of investment and meaning and worldview and all kinds of things. And so I think this notion of disclosure, we can critique it and criticize it, and I do, but it also... There's something about it that I think is significant.
Well, I understand why they can't do it because, you know, I think, and this is just my feeling, like you said, religions are used to beings coming from elsewhere. The government can't handle people knowing it, I think, because then they know how much the government's been lying. And you're talking about crimes, people being murdered. Like, I'm sure a lot of the people have died since whenever that was going on. But, you know, how do you trust your government when we're talking billions and billions of dollars, the money? You want to know why the military budget is so, like, how they could lose $1 billion or something? Like, you know, that's how it goes down that black project rabbit hole.
I think the language of disclosure, too, presumes that somebody actually knows something. And I'm not convinced anybody knows what's going on. I mean, I think it's very likely that there's a there.
I think they could show us the ship, though. They may not be able to explain it. You know what I mean? Like, just show it to us, man. Come on.
What if the thing to disclose is we have no idea what's going on? You know,
that's fine. I'm like you. I believe that to be true. Mm-hmm. I do. But I still think they got a ship somewhere.
Well, okay. That's another conversation up here. I'm not so sure about that either. But I could be wrong. I mean,
actually, I would love to hear why. Because I think it would really, you know, when you hear about so much back engineering and you know, we don't know. He's right. It certainly seemed to be an awful lot of scientists, you know. Hal Pudoff's been working on something all these years. You know,
yeah. Right? No, Hal has.
Jacques Vallée. I mean, we're talking like 50 years.
I'll tell you why I'm skeptical or suspicious, but which doesn't mean I'm right. Okay. I could be very, very wrong. I mean, they could pull the ship out tomorrow and I'm going to like, oops, check that one off. I'm wrong there. So I don't have any feeling about needing to be right here. Okay.
Yeah.
But here's why. I'll tell you why. First of all, there's a lot of things about the UFO phenomena that make absolutely no sense if they're extraterrestrial.
Yeah.
It just doesn't make any sense. And some of the most seasoned and knowledgeable researchers, like Jacques Vallée himself, do not actually accept the extraterrestrial hypothesis. They think it's wildly improbable. Okay?
I agree with that, actually.
Okay, so the whole notion of a ship, though, pulling a ship out presumes that the ship is coming from somewhere else.
But does it?
It's coming from somewhere else. Okay. We're gonna,
I'm not even talking about when, because with USOs, I mean, we know more about Mars than underwater. We have more of it mapped.
Yeah.
So I was kind of tickled by this theory of that they've been here longer than us. And that they may have been under the water the whole time. And I was like, so you're telling me some like amalgamation of Wakanda and Aquaman is literally true? Like, what are we? Okay. Wow.
Yeah. Well, okay. So that's one reason, OT. I'm going back to my doubts here. You're pulling us in another direction. Got us with Aquaman now, for God's sake.
So but they have the ships do travel underwater. So if they, let's say hypothetically, like some people say, create a gravity well around them, and that doesn't matter from space to atmosphere to underwater, they could still do these amazing. So if they could have been here the whole time, and their ships, and they have technology.
Listen,
I don't know.
Listen, I'm still with Aquaman here. You're in the movies here.
You wrote about mutants. Come on, man.
I did. It's my fault. I'm trying to explain to you though why I'm skeptical, and you keep going to Aquaman. So
I'm sorry.
I'm a bit puzzled here. Here's why, though. In my world, if you're going to research something, you need a citation and you need to be able to go somewhere and show X, Y, and Z. And we have none of that, Oteil. We have nothing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, and also we know from a lot of sources that a lot of the UFO phenomena is disinformation.
Yes, for sure.
We know that. Okay. So
for sure.
As an academic, as someone who is responsible for writing stuff that people can go and find the citations for, I've got nothing. You know, I've got stories. I've got lots of stories.
Yeah.
But I don't actually have the ship, or I don't have the bodies.
We do have the pilots that say that they saw it, and people on ships that say they saw the craft going underwater.
Correct. We have that. But we also have that in the history of religions. We have that in the history of culture and civilization. But that's never enough, is it? For these other people, I'm just telling you why.
Yeah,
I'm
for
skeptical.
Them. Yeah. No, we gotta be skeptical. Look, I'm all about. I live in my left brain and right brain. The left brain is to verify the things the way that it does, and the right brain is to, and they're supposed to work in harmony with each other to be like, hey, is this, you know, sometimes you just got to go, it just doesn't feel right to me. You know what I mean? So I totally get that. I'm not discounting the left brain. I'm very Virgo and analytical and like everything categorized. But, you know, I also like everything's on the table for me. Aquaman, good. Wakanda, you know, like, I don't know. And when things exhibit certain qualities, I have to go, well, and I'm encouraged that, you know, fighter pilots and all these really respected scientists would treat it that way, to be like, hey, all I know is I saw it. Like, that's not supposed to be able to happen.
Yeah. And that's what I meant earlier about the disclosure movement is it's actually very helpful that these sorts of people are talking about it, because otherwise, you know, this is why I wrote The Flip, by the way, to go back to the Flip. I teach at a very STEM oriented school. You know, most of the kids are going to grow up and be scientists, engineers or mathematicians of some sort. And I was using all these traditional religious resources because I teach the history of religions. And I know they were thinking, oh, well, these are religious people. They don't know their science. So if they did, they wouldn't say these ridiculous things. So I turned to the stories of scientists and engineers and medical professionals. And I was like, okay, now say that. And they can't, of course. They can still come up with reasons why these stories are illegitimate, but they can't say that the people don't know their science. You know?
Yes. Exactly. Can you name a few of those people? Some of these scientists?
Yeah. I mean, well, one of them is Kerry Mullis, who won the Nobel Prize for the human genome project early on. And he wrote a lot about his own abduction experience in a book called Dancing Naked in the Minefield. So Kerry, you know, Kerry's a Nobel Prize winner. Kerry's no longer with us, by the way.
Yeah.
I sat down with Kerry and I listened to this story and I read about it. And it's a very dramatic story. And his argument is essentially, look, I know you can't do science with this because it's not repeatable. And I know it'll be considered, you know, wild, but it actually all happened and it's real.
And I did just win a Nobel Prize for science.
Well, yeah. And so, you know, Kerry's just one of a couple dozen of these stories that I tell in that book. Another one is, you know, one that comes to mind is Bruce Grayson is actually his name. He's a psychiatrist retired now at the University of Virginia. And he tells this story of sitting down, this medical doctor asked Bruce to help him talk to his wife about his own near-death experience and how it fundamentally changed him. And he wanted help because he knew his wife would be very skeptical because she's also a doctor. And he just wanted help from Bruce to like talk to her. And so they sat down and he started to tell his story, and she stopped him, you know, after the first sentence or two, and says, wait a minute, I had one of those experiences too, and here it is. And so Bruce's story is that, look, these experiences are everywhere, including in our medical professionals who are not talking about them because they're ashamed of them, yeah, or they're afraid of what their peers will say, or sometimes what their wife will say or their husband will say.
Yeah.
But in fact, they're there. They're just there. And to me, that's a really powerful example of a story, in this case, medical professionals who really do struggle with these things, I think.
Do you know any other stories of scientists that actually use the metaphysical side to figure scientific things out?
Well, I've certainly heard those stories. Yeah, I mean, offhand, I can't name names because that's not how my memory works.
Yes, go get the books, folks.
At 61, yeah, your memory doesn't. But I've certainly heard of scientists who get ideas for their science from altered states and from dreams and from psychedelic states and things like that. But then they have to go and do the science, or they have to go and do the experiment, you know. So it's not an either or again. It's a kind of a both and approach. And you know, that's how, to take us back to Ingo, that's how remote viewing worked.
Yeah.
They use the remote viewers to access sensitive espionage sites, but they probably didn't act on any of that information alone. They probably also put it in concert with more reliable or technological means of spying. And so it was a kind of, you know, it was a kind of multiple approach that was effective, or was probably, we don't know actually how it was used.
That makes sense though.
Yeah. And again, that's my argument with something even like the humanities, is that a lot of these ideas, these big ideas, really come out of altered states, but then they're put into book form and they're put into an argument, and people sort of access them through this argument, you know?
Yes.
And so a lot of the intellectual life is itself a flipped state, but it's flipped in a kind of indirect way.
Mm. I had Stefan A. Schwartz on the podcast, and he was one of the people that helped me realize, and from watching him on other podcasts, like on Jeffrey Mishlove and stuff, that there is a lot of science that has been done, like the University of Virginia did all these, documented all these kids that could say where they were in a past life, where they lived, how they died, blah, blah, blah. I think it was like 1700 or it was a bunch. And they were able to like go find out, yeah, this guy did live here and this guy did die that way. And, you know, he did a lot of experiments himself, you know, remote viewing to find archaeological objects that were lost, Cleopatra's tomb or something like that. So as I talk to people and they laugh at me, I'm like, you know, the stuff is up there on Google Scholar. Like, I'm not, the science has been done, that, you know, in a lot of different areas.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. The children who remember previous lives, what are called CORT, cases of the reincarnation type, those were at the University of Virginia with a psychiatrist named Ian Stevenson, and then a successor named Jim Tucker, who is a child psychiatrist and studies the same kind of thing. And most people who've looked at that material come away impressed that it isn't easy to explain away. It doesn't necessarily prove reincarnation, but it sure suggests something like that.
Well, they were able to get that info somehow, even if it wasn't them.
Yeah.
They tapped into.
Yeah. But my point is that, people who have looked at that, I mean, really thoughtful, careful people are generally really impressed with the cases. There were 1,600 cases or 2,600 cases. I can't remember the number that Ian Stevenson put together, and then Jim has done a number of others. So it's all there. It's all in the record.
Yeah, I think some of this stuff is hard to argue with. Okay, and if you have to go,
Yeah, it's soon because there's a 2-year-old, by the way, downstairs. No. With you. I'm a grandpa now, and I'm on duty.
I love it. Well, look, I thank you so much for your time. There's no way I could have fit everything in that I wanted to get in anyway, but I really appreciate it, and it's great to meet you. And thank you for your books. You say you don't have any superpowers. But these books, I will have to argue with you vociferously.
Sorry. Yeah, well, if I have a superpower, it's writing for sure. And I love to write. And I actually have a whole theory. Let's do this again. But I have a whole theory about the paranormal in writing that I think you'd find really useful. I think they're very much related.
Let me tell you this quick story. It's super quick since you mentioned the paranormal in writing. I have these friends that don't believe in stuff mystical. And I think the mystics sent them to me. And this one friend of mine that I have lunch with often, I was like, you know, I just ask people, nothing weird ever happened to you? Like, come on, that's a long life, something. And he goes, nah. He goes, well, there is this one thing. I was like, all right. He goes, well, sometimes I have to write something. He has spoken on TV. He's the president of a Autism Foundation. Like, he has to do stuff. He's an attorney, volunteer police officer. He had to write things where he would have to talk on CNN, right? Uh-huh. He was like, I'll have to write something. I wake up the next morning and I wrote the whole thing in my sleep. And I have to make minor changes.
Yeah.
Like, it's coherent.
Yeah.
Topped, almost ready to go on TV.
Yeah.
And I was like, and you don't think that's weird? He was like, oh, that's just, I'm like, oh man, come on, bro. Dude, what's it gonna take? Like, so I don't know.
Yeah, but no, I worked with a major channeler for a while, Paul Selig is his name, and that's how he writes, by the way. He just gets these downloads, and you know, he'll start the next day at exactly where, well, the guides, as he calls them, will start the next day exactly where they left off, and they'll write a whole book in a couple weeks like this.
I heard Star Trek's were kind of, I feel like a lot of all this stuff, I feel like we're, what is that term I heard? Pre-membering? I was like, wow. Well, thank you so much, man. You've been, it's been a great relief to find you and your books.
Yeah, no, it's fun too, just talking to you. I laugh a lot just listening to you. And, Tia, let's do it again. Seriously. I'm leaving because, again, there's a 2-year-old downstairs.
It's fine. I got to go pick up my kids, get out at 3. So,
yeah,
definitely. They're my biggest flip now. Watching them, it's like, who needs acid? This is great. Right. You have a great day, man. Thank you so much.
All right. Take care.
Pantheon Media presents Comes a Time, featuring Mike Fenoya and Oteil Burbridge. Executive produced by Christian Swain and Peter Ferrioli. Produced and edited by Eric Limarenko and Stu Silverman. We hope you enjoyed this episode of Comes a Time with Mike Fenoya and Oteil Burbridge. Be sure to follow the pod on social media, YouTube, and if you're jonesing for bonus episodes and exclusive content, go to patreon.com/comesatimepod. And get on the bus.